Alan Ryan says in the New York Review of Books that to write a comprehensive history of Europe between the end of World War II and the early weeks of 2005, all within one book, is on the face of it impossible. And yet he says Tony Judd has pulled it off. Post-war, A History of Europe Since 1945 is published by Penguin and brings Tony Judd, currently a professor of European studies and director of the Remark Institute at NYU, back to my show today. It's always good to see you.
Thank you very much.
This covers the history of 40-plus European nations in the 60 years since the war. What compelled you to take on such a huge project? And did you expect the book to be this big, 878 pages?
Oh, no, please don't remind me. I certainly didn't expect it to be this big. I was living in Vienna at the time of the end of communism and the wall came down in Berlin and all the regimes collapsed. And it struck me as a sort of working historian who teaches modern European history that we were going to need to completely rethink the post-war years now that what we had thought of as a permanent situation had proven just to be a 50-year parenthesis.
And but that was 1989.
That was 1989.
A lot has happened since in those 16 years.
In a way, it's a very good thing, because although I sat down there and thought I'll write a little essay about this, it turned into a long essay and then a long book. But of course, I also had the advantage of 16 years in which you could see a little better what had really happened and what changes were going to happen. And also all kinds of archives opened up in former communist countries, and you had access to information that you couldn't have had before.
Now, you've done this in a loosely chronological way, but it's been suggested that you've adapted a cinematic approach in order to shift the focus from one theme or region to another. Was that your intention?
I wish I could say it was, or rather, I wish I could say I knew what that meant. I certainly use cinema a lot, because it was, for the first half of the period, the popular art. And not only popular, it was the high art of Europe at the time. And so it may be that sort of the fairly frequent references to film as a way of capturing something about the moment in each of these countries may have induced me to sort of think cinematically, but I wish I could say more than that.
To understand the last 60 years of European history, it's essential that we understand what Europe looked like immediately after the war. How would you describe Europe in those years?
I think it's almost impossible for anyone living in a Western country today to capture a full sense of what it was really like. Some kind of an image from contemporary Baghdad, perhaps, might capture it, but even then, probably not. The scale of destruction, of physical destruction, of the destruction of transport, of houses, of cities, and above all, the tens of millions of human beings, and indeed the hundreds of thousands of children, orphaned children, wandering homeless across the continent. I think it's that, and it was noticed at the time by the Allied armies, Eisenhower commented on it as well, it's that which it's very hard for us to grasp.
90% of Warsaw's housing stock had been destroyed.
Absolutely.
Maybe that was the worst, but whole Yugoslavia was seriously destroyed, and other, of course, France and Germany.
Absolutely, although on the whole, the rule of thumb is that the further east you went, the worse it was.
And then what about just recovering from all the dead? 35 million in the European theater alone, and many civilians. Unlike World War One, most of the deaths were, the casualties were soldiers.
Absolutely. The only country in Europe which had more military casualties than it had civilian casualties, and by far, was Great Britain. And of course, the reason is that it wasn't occupied. And that's the point. The World War II was a war which, for most Europeans, was fought briefly at the beginning and then briefly at the end, and for much of the intervening time was occupation. So you had civil war, ethnic cleansing, genocide, repression, punishments, collective reprisals, all targeted towards citizens who were not in military uniform.
As a result, de Gaulle said that it would take 25 years of furious effort to dig France out of the ruins of war, and yet it didn't happen.
Indeed. There was an expectation, and de Gaulle was just one of many people who thought this, that if Europe ever recovered, and there was some question as to whether it would take a generation. And what is striking, and I can recall this from my own childhood growing up in England, is that by the, let's say, the middle 1950s, it varies from country to country, Europe was already more prosperous than it had been at any point since 1913.
Well, England was one of the countries that took longer to recover than many. You were born in 1948. I'm sure you remember that. There were parts of London that were still in rubble into the 60s.
Oh, I can well remember, because as a child, my favorite place to play with my friends was always in a bomb site. And very often you'd be chased out of the bomb site by the police because not all the bomb sites had been thoroughly checked yet, and there might still be unexploded shells and so on there. I can recall, I think, probably that at Winston Churchill's funeral in 1965, it's fair to say that there was a sort of sense of closure, that not the memory of the war, but the physical presence of the war was finally behind us. But that's 20 years.
My guest is Tony Jett, and his book is Postwar, A History of Europe Since 1945, published by the Penguin Press. As a historian of modern Europe, you've run up against master narratives that get taught year after year to new generations. What is a master narrative?
Well, it's a rather pretentious way of saying a large theory of how history works or what the particular story should be. And I guess in my generation, the most dominant master narrative was Marxism, basically a theory which said that not only does history have a particular direction, but we know what that direction is, and some countries are moving faster in it towards socialism and communism, and others are not. And so anything you observe in politics, any economic data, any political conflict, any social information fits into this story. So it's an overarching narrative.
Well, how serious was the prospect of radical political change between, in the early years, between 45 and what was it, 52 or so?
The early 50s, yeah. The main fear on the part of most West European observers, including American observers like Marshall, the Secretary of State Marshall himself, was that Europe would either slip back into fascism, and no one had any good reason for thinking that wouldn't happen, or be propelled, as it were, forward into communism, in both cases because of the sort of economic desperation and the sense of hopelessness that most Europeans still lived in.
Now, slip back to fascism because many of the attitudes that had led to the war remained. Anti-Semitism was still rampant.
Anti-Semitism, absolutely. There are many instances, not only in Eastern Europe, of Jews being attacked and killed and pushed out of countries like Poland and Hungary, but in Western Europe too. In France, in the immediate post-war years, it wasn't always wise for Jews to reclaim their apartments if they came back from a concentration camp, because there was in one case a riot in the streets. I can remember as a child growing up in London, as a Jewish child, that anti-Semitism was still quite widespread and normal.
And yet the national myth of France was that all but a few people were opposed to the Nazi occupation.
I'm afraid that was the national myth of most countries. France is a famous case, perhaps, because of the image of the resistance. But if you take the Netherlands, which is a country which prides itself today on being philo-Semitic and open and tolerant, 23,000 Dutchmen signed up for the Waffen-SS, which is the largest contingent from Western Europe. 110,000 Dutch Jews were expelled to the concentration camps, of a total of 140,000. Only 5,000 survived. And it's worth remembering that Anne Frank and her family were betrayed not by a German, but by a Dutchman.
You were here last to talk about Past Imperfect, your study of French intellectuals from 1944 to 1956. It was an account of the love affair between French intellectuals and communism. A doomed love affair?
Certainly a doomed love affair, but like most love affairs that are doomed, it had a sort of long half-life during which there's a sort of nostalgic looking back. I think you can see that many of the people who realized that between the years 48 and 56 that what they were in love with was a brutal authoritarian regime still for many years afterwards regretted that it was the case and that they couldn't return to that sense of optimistic innocence.
But they weren't the people who led to 1968. Were they the same people who then led to the election of Mitterrand?
No, there are two different generations at work here. The 68 generation, which is my generation, I suppose, in France, mostly consisted of young men and women who had been politicized, if they were politicized, either by the Algerian War or by the university transformations of the 1960s. And indeed, one forgets, looking back, compared to the events in France in the last week or so, how relatively non-violent and quite light-hearted and playful the events of the 60s were. Mitterrand's election, sort of 13 years later, however, is an interesting reminder that well into the beginning of the 1980s, many people in France, and not only in France, still had the illusion that you could somehow, with one fell swoop, transit out of capitalism and into socialism.
And that, what's interesting there, the irony there, is Mitterrand was actually implicated in the Vichy regime, as we learned later.
But we didn't learn it until he was almost dead.
You said that the love affair with communism perhaps died because of the recognition of the repressive aspects of communism. But what about the dramatic improvement of the economies of Western Europe after the early 50s? Within 10 years of the end of the war, France, Germany, Italy, other European countries were better off than they had ever been. It wasn't a return to pre-war situation. It was much better than the pre-war.
Absolutely.
Situation.
I mean, first it was a picking up of the threads that had been dropped, as it were, in 1914, so that you got a return to the trading and productivity and employment levels that Europe had once known at the end of the 19th and early 20th century, but which had catastrophically been destroyed in two world wars and the Depression. But I think that the reason for the decline of communism in the sort of enthusiasms of Westerners, at least, has to be split between the intellectuals, who never were attracted to it because of any particular economic motive, but because of its appeal as a once-and-for-all solution to all the evils of the world. And, of course, it was taking place somewhere else, so they had no direct experience of it. But the people who voted for the Communist Party in Italy and France, in the West, which is the two main party cases, weren't necessarily voting out of economic despair. The Italian Communist Party got its highest ever vote in 1976, long after the Italian miracle, economic miracle, had begun to bite, and most of the voters were vastly better off than their parents had been. So they were voting in a kind of combination of protest at Christian democratic corruption or a tradition of voting en bloc by class and so on.
And it was mostly in the North where the economy was booming.
Absolutely.
Best.
In the impoverished South, people tended to vote for the Catholic parties.
After you say that after 1945, it was more difficult for the European states to aspire to international or imperial status. And yet, it wasn't until the 60s that European countries finally granted independence to almost all of their colonies. They did it piecemeal, but it took a long time. Why did it take so long?
Well, I think, of course, your opening point there is part of the answer. It was because of World War II that countries like France or Belgium were more likely to cling to their colonies as best they could because they had so been so deeply humiliated and reduced in Europe itself. And it took them a while to realize that clinging to the colonies was both impossible politically and probably dysfunctional economically. A slightly different case is Great Britain. The British gave up India very fast after the war because they knew they couldn't hold it after the war. They couldn't hold it militarily. They couldn't hold it economically. It cost too much. They didn't have the soldiers. But they clung on to the African colonies rather longer. And it was really only after Suez, the humiliation at Suez, when the Egyptian leader Nasser, supported in this case by Eisenhower, of course, told the French and the British to get out of Suez, and they had no choice but to do so, that the British and French in different ways realized that their colonial identity was doomed.
The French had already, Britain had already given up India.
Right.
And the French had suffered a humiliating defeat in
Indochina.
Right. And by the early 60s were facing serious attrition in North Africa, in Algeria. I was in Paris in 1961, and I remember having submachine guns aimed at me constantly every time I walked by a government building because it was such a dangerous place. I guess nothing has occurred like that since until just recently.
No, and I think even just recently, it's nothing comparable. I remember as a child sitting in a car with my father in the Place de la Concorde in Paris, and indeed 1961, I think, and the whole of the place was full of cars honking Algérie Française, three long honks and two short ones, Algérie Française, and a guy with some kind of weapon, I can't remember what it was now, came over, not a policeman, some character on the street, came over, leaned into the car and asked us in French, are you for or against? And it was pretty clear what the question was. So my father sort of dishonestly but wisely said he was for, and the guy walked on. But it was a really violent and anarchic atmosphere.
and not much later, France came to grips with it.
De Gaulle gave Algeria up. It was perfectly clear he couldn't hold it.
What about some of the other European myths? We talked a bit about how they dealt with collaboration with the Nazis and participation in the extermination of the Jews. What about the Austrians thinking of themselves as victims for so many years? Weren't they probably as implicated as any country?
Oh, much more so. The percentage of Austrians who had held high ranks in the SS or were concentration camp guards or administered the Final Solution in one way or another is vastly higher than the percent as a percentage of the population than the number of Germans. The difference was this, that both the Russians and the British and the Americans agreed during the war to treat Austria as though it was a victim of Hitler rather than a collaborator. And this was a conscious lie, if you want to think of it in these terms, as a device for trying to rehabilitate post-war Austria and not turn it against them.
What about the Eastern European countries? Wasn't it more complicated because many of them had supported the Nazis and now were communist countries?
It varied, I mean, from country to country, but there had been strong support for Hitler, mostly because of anti-Soviet motives, in the Baltic states, in Poland, a little bit, not as much, in Romania, in Hungary. What, of course, happened after the Second World War was that the German oppression was followed in short order by the Soviet one, and so memories moved on very fast. And there's been a tendency until very recently for East Europeans to remember above all the Soviet repression, because it lasted much longer after all, from 1946 or 47 right up to the recent last decade, whereas the German one only lasted 4 or 5 years. And you could tell yourselves that you were just as much victims of it as anyone else. And that mismemory got locked into East European collective politics.
Even in East Germany?
To a lesser extent, but don't forget that East Germans were all told by the communist regime that took over in 46 that Nazism was primarily a capitalist exercise and therefore a West German one. And it's true that the East Germans paid reparation just like the West Germans did, but they paid it to Russia.
Tony Judd is the author or editor of 11 books, the most recent post-war history of Europe since 1945. It's published by the Penguin Press, and we will continue our conversation after this. I'm Leonard Lopate. Welcome back to my show. I'm talking with Tony Judd, who is a professor of European Studies and director of the Remarque Institute at NYU. His latest book is called Postwar: History of Europe Since 1945, and it's published by the Penguin Press. You said that you've been living in the United States for the past 20 years. Did that help at all? Did that give a perspective that living in England might not have if you'd been an academic there?
Oh, I think so. I think, curiously, living in New York, which is where I live, one is much closer to Europe than one is in England. I taught in Oxford before, which is a strange and slightly provincial town that feels or felt then a long way from continental Europe, whereas New York, despite being far enough away to give you perspective, feels quite close.
And to many Americans, New York is really a European city that just happens to be attached to another country called the United States.
I wouldn't go quite that far, but I know what they mean.
We were talking about national myths. What about the Soviet Union's national myth? First of all, you know, many POWs preferred not to be returned to the Soviet Union after the defeat of Germany and were forcibly returned. How did the Soviet Union deal with that? How did it deal with all of the excesses that preceded the war with Germany? And did it also see itself as a victim, as Austria had?
Well, of course, the Soviet Union, the people of the Soviet Union, were by far the largest victim of the war. There were about 16 million civilians killed and about 8 million soldiers killed, which means there were 24 million, compared just proportion to roughly 250,000 Americans killed in the whole of the Second World War, civilians and soldiers combined. The Soviet Union came out of the Second World War, of course, in its own eyes as a major victor. I mean, a huge victim of the war, but also the only unambiguous winner of the war, together with Great Britain in Europe itself. And while it's true that there was a memory of the horrors of the 1930s, and there was in fact just about to be another second Stalinist ice age from 1948 until his death in 1953, the overwhelming memory of the Second World War for most Russians who experienced it, i.e. for older Russians today, is on the whole a sort of mixed one of sacrifice and pride. They won the war. They suffered enormously. And there's quite a lot of resentment at East Europeans, you know, Poles, Hungarians and others, for not being grateful to them for having liberated them from Nazism. So it's a mixed recollection for them.
Eastern European communism was in serious trouble for at least two decades before its collapse. Why did the Soviet Union take so long to finally admit that it had serious problems?
Well, I think that until you got past the Brezhnev generation, it was very hard for them actually to see these problems as problems. They just, to a much larger extent than we're always ready to recognize, the leaders in the generation of Khrushchev and Brezhnev believed their own ideology. So when they said that they thought that these were either transitional problems or the problems caused by troublemakers or issues that could be addressed by more socialism rather than less, they actually believed this. This is not cynicism. And it's not until you get Gorbachev, who comes into office in the middle of the 1980s and who is young enough, is born in the early 1930s, to be essentially a post-Stalinist bureaucrat, that you have someone who can look around and say, as he said to his wife, in fact, as he came into office, "We just can't go on like this." It was that sort of acknowledgement that the older generation, who stayed in office and stayed in power until the early 1980s, simply couldn't make.
You suggest that the Cold War had a positive effect on the Western European recovery.
Well, there's no doubt that the Cold War had beneficial effects for West Europeans in two ways, I think. One is that it cut them off from the impoverished eastern half of the continent. Every East European country except Czechoslovakia was poorer than every West European country. And what that meant was that when it came time to build what we now think of as the European Union, and before it the European Economic Community and so on, you were dealing primarily with medium-sized or large countries that were, by world standards, enormously prosperous anyway and didn't have the problems that the East Europeans had. But the second factor, of course, is that West Europeans lived, most of them, under the American nuclear umbrella. And so they were saved the huge expense of paying for their own defense. And that, too, allowed them to turn to other expenditures, and they became prosperous.
But you say also, without an ambitious ideological program for Europe's future, and the accidental European model was born. What's the European model?
Well, what I mean by the accidental European model is that no one sat down in 1945 and said, "Hey guys, we can't go on like this. We've got to build a better Europe. Let's create a European Union." It was born of a series of self-interested decisions. But what has come out of it, it seems to me, is two general points that one can make, even though there are many variations by country. The first is that within countries, there is an acceptance that the state has to play a certain kind of role in providing, whether you want to call it a welfare base or a security base or whatever it is, that will prevent Europeans falling back into the condition of before the war.
Because the 30s, there was so much economic distress.
Absolutely.
Which seemed to breed political extremism.
It bred fascism, was the simple.
So they got, you know, universal health care, unemployment benefits, paid vacations, generous pensions, the socioeconomic incentives that keep democracy's doubters on hold. But now we have much of that being undermined. Conservative governments in recent years have been chipping away at some of those social safeguards. So have they forgotten those lessons, or has Europe moved to a point where they don't need them anymore?
Well, there's no doubt that the younger generation doesn't remember the reasons why they have a welfare state in the first place. That's true. Inevitably, you're now dealing with a majority of the population that has no direct memory of the 30s and 40s. But I think that one mustn't overestimate the extent to which conservatives have really started to chip away at the welfare state in Europe. The three most efficient European economies, which are competitive on by any criteria with the United States, are Finland, Denmark, and Norway, and there's nothing chipped away about their welfare states. And on the whole, conservatives, even ultra-conservatives like Margaret Thatcher, were very careful not even to touch the core issues in the welfare state, which primarily are state education and national health systems. The reason for that, of course, is that the overwhelming majority of the beneficiaries of the welfare state were the middle class, not the working class. It was middle class people who now, because all these services are provided free, had more discretionary income to spend on vacations and luxuries and so forth. So the European middle and upper middle class is just as locked in to the model of a certain kind of service providing high tax but high security state as the workers are. And that's, I think, why it won't change radically.
Do the basic tenets of the European model hold true if Turkey becomes a member of the EU?
I suspect that the tenets of the European model are already facing problems for the kinds of reasons that Turkey would simply make worse, and that is that Europe, although its wealth was built on cheap immigrant labor to some extent in the 50s and 60s, including Turks as well as North Africans and Caribbean and African immigrants and so forth, it has no cultural frame, and we're seeing this in France today, for absorbing huge numbers of these people into an essentially sort of pre-immigrant political culture. If Turkey comes in, curiously, it would be an enormously strengthening thing for Europe as a whole, because it would give it much more influence and leverage in the Middle East and in Asia and stabilize it politically and militarily. But there's also no doubt that it would provoke all kinds of populist demagogues into action against Turkey, against the threat of Turks rolling up by their hundreds of thousands in their own countries. Yes.
A recent book claimed that the European model represents a more serious challenge to the American way of life, or at least to American economic dominance, than China does. Would you agree to that?
I would partially agree with that. Europeans are not about to undercut the American economy in the way that China may well do. But the European model of governance, the way in which states relate to each other, in which they accept a certain amount of external intrusion in return for international stability, the volume of wealth and political security and general comfort level that Europeans have provided for themselves, the fact that most Europeans live longer, healthier lives than most Americans, and that Europe in many ways is a much more stable continent than America has been in recent years, all points to the possibility, at least, that Europe will be a better model on offer to the rest of the world than America will be in years to come.
But what is the rejection of a European constitution by France and other countries tell us about the future of a sense of European unity? Is it unlikely there'll ever be a United States of Europe?
I don't think there'll ever be a United States of Europe, I quite agree. But I don't think that was ever on the cards. What might have been on the cards and may well now be threatened was some sort of collective vision of the role that Europe could play in the world as a major actor in world affairs. And the reason that's weakened, I'm afraid, is because the political class in France, in Britain under Blair, in Germany and the Netherlands and elsewhere, has been far too obsessed with scoring points against Brussels in order to benefit themselves in domestic politics. And you saw in those referenda the price that gets paid for that.
And part of it was the whole matter of a multicultural future. We were talking a bit about Turkey. Well, Bulgaria is another possibility. And between them, we're talking about, 15 million Muslims currently in the U.S., the EU, but another 80 million Muslims waiting to be admitted if Bulgaria and Turkey join. There are a lot of people who are very upset about
that. Right, but the irony is that although politicians in Europe, particularly right-wing politicians, talk about the threat to Europe's Christian identity, the real problem is the reverse. Europe is a largely de-Christianized continent today, but most of the Muslims, it's feared, will be much more religious. And in these secular European societies, their primary allegiance to their religion and their culture will be a threat to Europe's sense of its what it is now to be modern and post-religious. In that sense, the Muslims would make Europe look rather more like America, and with all the problems that raises for a secular political system.
If you had written this book when you first conceived it 16 years ago, how different would your assessments of the future of Europe have been?
I would have been probably both more optimistic and more pessimistic. I'd have been more optimistic because it seemed then in 1989 that with the opening up of Eastern Europe and the possibility of a benevolent environment for the expansion of Europe to take in all of these countries, you could imagine Europe peacefully, finally overcoming all its World War II and post-war divisions. I'm pessimistic because the West Europeans took so long deliberately to allow the East Europeans in that a sense built up that enlargement was a problem, and the more you enlarge, the bigger the problem. So that now the big question in Europe, as you rightly said, Leonard, is if we don't take in Turkey, what are we going to do with Turkey? And if we do take in Turkey, how can we still be Europe?
In the acknowledgments, you mentioned that your son Daniel gave the book its title, and your son Nathaniel reminded you that not all stories have a happy ending.
Well, it's indeed true. My older son, Daniel, was getting a little bored with me agonizing over what I should call the book. And he said, he's 11 years old, and he said, well, Dad, what's the book about? And I said, well, it's about post-war Europe. He said, well, then call it post-war. and can we now get back to baseball? And my younger son, who's 8 years old and has a rather sort of morbid sense of the tragic view of life, keeps writing stories with rather depressing endings about how children always end up badly. And I'm not quite sure why he does this, but he wanted my book to remind people, as he said, that not everything turns out well. And I'm afraid it may do that.
Tony Judd's book is Postwar. Thank you, Daniel. A History of Europe Since 1945. It's published by the Penguin Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.